dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go,
you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Finner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, KRFP Moscow, 91.3 Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. A listener called me this week to ask that we pay some serious attention to developments in the ongoing vote rigging and stolen U.S. election that have failed to get much attention, even in alternative media. So we'll take a break this week with our coverage on strategies to deal with the coming of peak oil and return to that in future programs. The rigging of the U.S. elections by the Republicans and the Democrats' failure to defend their own victory in now two presidential contests is hard to make sense of except in the context of peak oil and oil's central role in the project of American empire. National security, as defined by American leaders, both Democrat and Republican, can be seen to be maintaining and expanding the wealth of the wealthy, the power of the powerful, and maintaining the superpower status of the United States. Necessary to this project is convincing the American population into going along with the program by framing this bottom-line quest in idealistic terms, such as the championing of democracy globally. First, a few facts about the status of our election process. There is no federal agency with regulatory authority or oversight of the U.S. voting machine industry, though given that the persons benefiting from fraud also make the appointments to the agencies, that in itself would be no guarantee of clean elections. 80% of all votes in America are counted by only two companies, Diebold and ES&S. The vice president of Diebold and the president of ES&S are brothers. The chairman and CEO of Diebold is a major Bush campaign organizer and donor who wrote in 2003 that he was, quote, committed to helping Ohio deliver its electoral votes to the president next year, close quote. Republican Senator Chuck Hagel used to be chairman of ES&S. ES&S is the largest voting machine manufacturer in the U.S. and counts almost 60% of all U.S. votes. Hagel became senator based on votes counted by ES&S machines and was recently caught lying about his ownership of ES&S by the Senate Ethics Committee. Hagel, long connected with the Bush family, was on a short list of Bush's vice presidential candidates. The other major company, Diebold, is based in Ohio. Diebold also makes ATMs, checkout scanners, and ticket machines, all of which log each transaction and can generate a paper trail. However, Diebold's new touchscreen voting machines have no paper trail of any votes. In other words, there is no way to verify that the data coming out of the machine is the same as what was legitimately put in by voters. Diebold employed five convicted felons as senior managers and developers to help write the central compiler computer code that counted 50% of the votes in 30 states. Jeff Dean, Diebold's senior vice president and senior programmer on Diebold's central compiler code, had previously been convicted of computer fraud and embezzlement, which included planting backdoors in his software and using a, quote, high degree of sophistication, unquote, that enabled the hack to go undetected over a period of 2 years. California has banned the use of Diebold machines because the security was so bad. And to highlight that, a group of computer scientists showed that a chimpanzee was capable of altering the results in Diebold machines. All, not some, but all the voting machine errors detected and reported in Florida went in favor of Bush or Republican candidates. Serious voting anomalies in Florida, where Bush's brother Jeb is governor, have been mathematically demonstrated, and experts are recommending further investigation. And now, Clint Curtis, a Florida computer programmer, has come forward and in a notarized affidavit asserted that he was hired prior to the 2000 election by Tom Feeney, now a Republican member of Congress, to write a program to rig the vote in Florida in favor of the Republicans. Wayne Madsen, an investigative journalist who was a former operative with the National Security Agency, has been covering this emerging story in a series of articles published in the online journal. This story has been getting little coverage even in the alternative media. And even high-profile activists in the vote protection movement, like Bev Harris of Black Box Voting, have publicly distanced themselves from the story. We're going to get into the story here by starting with an interview done last week by Mark Badawi and Pokey Anderson, who host the Sunday Monitor program on KPFT Radio in Houston. Here's Mark Badawi.
Well, joining us again is Wayne Madsen. Wayne, welcome again to the Sunday Monitor.
Hi, good to be with you.
Now, Wayne, for people who haven't listened to this show regularly, it appears fairly frequently on this show, and predominantly because he has such shocking information in many cases, which has often turned out to be quite accurate. And one of those stories that you're working on right now, Wayne, and I guess we should give people a thumbnail sketch of what the story is in case they weren't listening last week. Can you just give us a quick rundown of how it all started and what you're looking at?
Well, there was information floating around various, what I have to say are informed circles in Houston and elsewhere, that the money that was used to pay for technicians and programmers to rig this election came through a circuitous route that's been long connected to Bush family activities going back to the days of BCCI and Iran-Contra and other nefarious exploits, and that this circuitous network and this tranche of money that's been used in the past, a tranche of money that's been associated with the Saudis, was used once again to pay people to come up with the software, especially that which was used on touchscreen voting machines to fix this election, basically to cause votes to switch from one candidate to another, not for a large margin, but just enough votes to for the Republican candidates to squeak by. And certainly one of the things I have discovered within the last week, that the 2004 election was not the only election where this rigged software was used. It was used as early as the 2000 election, which Al Gore, as we know, lost by a very narrow margin.
Now, these are obviously very serious allegations. What kind of proof do you have? Last week you mentioned the $29 million check. What's happened with that?
Well,
what do you know about it?
Yeah, it turns out that the $29 million check, although a valuable clue, was a fake. But it looks like the people who released the check did so as a way to say, hey, look here. Don't look at the check. Look who's behind it. Look around it. Follow the money that these people have been involved with passing through various offshore entities in the past.
So you think it was a clue to help you instead of hinder you?
I believe the intention might have been to hinder, because the check obviously represents a scam involving Nigerian scammers, but also involves individuals who apparently have been tied, and from documents that I've received from the U.S. District Court here in Washington, D.C., the person who obviously was involved in this this bogus check has had an absolute verified past history with the CIA, because the CIA is claiming that two documents he requested per a Freedom of Information Act request cannot be released because of national security grounds.
So if all this stuff is indeed true, that there was software that's being used to rig the election, how are we ever going to get this information out? And do you see any prospect of this being accepted as actually having happened at some point? I mean, it sounds at this stage, and you know me, so you know I'm not accusing you of anything.
Right.
But people on the right and people who want to move on, so-called, from democracy, in a sense, that the vote shouldn't matter anymore and we should have be over it, will say that this sounds like a conspiracy theory and that you don't have any proof. Where do you take this from here, and how do you answer those allegations?
Well, I'm going to get this article out. I've got, you know, help from researchers here in Washington, on the net, on the web. People, especially with the Democratic Underground, have been very good in helping to follow leads and get clues. I'm going to try to get this article sent out tonight. Probably won't get posted till the morning. As far as proof, I've got a notarized affidavit from one of the programmers that was involved in rigging the software. It took place. The genesis for this was not this year or last year. It was in 1999 in Florida, involving a U.S. government contractor with contracts with NASA. The individual in question has come forward, I think people will hear more about what he has to say in the coming week, because there's going to be a forum sponsored by Michigan Congressman John Conyers on Wednesday, and I think a lot of people will hear what the background for this story is if they watch C-SPAN.
Now, you mentioned Democratic Underground, and I wanted just to give people a quick link, something that I saw on there that was very interesting. If you go to safevoting.org, you can download a video clip of actually something that took place in Texas, I believe. It was a Diebold software meeting where they were trying to certify a machine, and they are on tape saying that it's got problems and it doesn't count and the tally doesn't match the vote, and but we'll certify it anyway because we've done it in the past. So it's a very interesting video clip at safevoting.org. Wayne, you mentioned a signed affidavit. What motivates someone like that to publicly express these things? Is it sour grapes at not being paid, or what happened?
Well, no, it's it wasn't sour grapes. The person obviously was under the impression when he was first asked to create a program that it was going to be used to prevent fraud using touchscreen machines, but soon realized it had an entirely opposite purpose. It's not that the person has been trying to keep this secret. I have to blame the news media. The individual, this results from a huge whistleblower case in Florida involving a contractor for the Florida Department of Transportation. One of the things that will be coming out in the article is we have information pretty much proves that the chief investigator for the Florida Department of Transportation that was looking into this company, this contractor, and its involvement in creating vote rigging software. They say he committed suicide back in on July 1st, 2003 of last year, but we have evidence to show that it was not suicide, that likely he was murdered because he was going places where a lot of people were getting nervous.
Well, that partially answers my next question, which was going to be, you know, something like this would have to involve a serious number of people keeping quiet, and you know, how do you keep a large number of people quiet when this kind of potential vote rigging is going on? And I guess you already partly answered that. Do you have any more thoughts on the number of people that would have to be involved in this to make it work, and then making sure that they all stay quiet?
Yeah, of course, it's like every other past scandal, like Iran-Contra and the BCCI scandal. You know, small groups of people know so much about their particular area, with the area the part they play. Very few people have the big picture. And that's one of the things that's been really difficult in following this story, with bogus checks and false leads. And what one former Department of Justice prosecutor told me is typical of organized criminal syndicates and covert activities that these feints, as he called them, are put up. They run parallel to the actual movement of money, and it's used to, of course, throw government investigators off the track, and that's why this stuff is done, using these offshore accounts and these people who are, you know, con men. The CIA has used in the past many con men, and some people would suggest that the current director of the CIA is one of them.
Well, that's I don't even know what to say about that. I was going to ask you something about the locking down of precincts in the first article you wrote. Our previous guest, actually the first guest we had, was talking about the media being kept out of various places where they were doing counts, and that was a serious red flag for him. You wrote about locking down of precincts where votes were being tallied. How many of those can be verified? How many precincts were locked down?
Well, apparently there was one report out of Warren County, Ohio, but now there's reports from around the country that similar things took place. I believe New Mexico, North Carolina, Florida, at places in Texas and Southern California, similar things happened.
Do you have any suggested places where people can look where they can find out where that happened?
Actually, I just found out, Wayne, that in Harris County at the big tabulation place on the evening of the election, there was a power outage. It was at Reliant Center, and it was the Reliant Company's electricity that went out for several hours, and people were told to go home.
Yeah, so Harris County is here in Texas. For those listening on the web, I know some do. So that's a local interest story for us. Do you have any suggested places where people can get more information on those things? Because I've had some questions about that. You know, the one case in Ohio is fairly well known, but you're saying it's happening elsewhere as well.
I think anybody who would look at Riverside County, California, may find some irregularities there. Why California? Well, obviously everybody knew that was going to go for John Kerry, but we saw an increase in Bush's vote in California, which is rather surprising from what he got in the 2000 election. And there's some thought that in Texas and California, very populous states, of course, that the votes were padded to give Bush this three and a half million national vote, popular vote margin, which would be part of the obviously part of the scam to make it look like he had a runaway victory. But it looks very apparent that because of the problems with the software, now we have evidence of this vote switching program that was designed to suppress Democratic vote. We have the name of the then Speaker of the Florida House of Representatives, who personally requested that this work be done because he was a chief lobbyist and general counsel for the firm that was a NASA contractor and a state of Florida contractor that performed the development of the software. A current congressman, Republican Congressman Tom Feeney. So this isn't a case of having dead people vote in Chicago any longer. This was a huge criminal enterprise. It affected a number of elections, affected a number of candidates who likely won their elections, but the results showed they lost. Everyone from Gray Davis in California to Max Cleland in Georgia, possibly Janet Reno and her unsuccessful bid to become the Democratic candidate for governor of Florida. The evidence is there, and I think if we had an FBI we could rely on, this is a criminal investigation having to do with money laundering, having to do with influence peddling, with bribery, and it's no longer just vote fraud. This is a criminal investigation and should be treated as one.
Wayne, looking back at some of the scandals that we've been through in the last few years, like Enron, Abu Ghraib, and so on, there's a tendency, the moment the light shines, for all the mice to run away and leave one in the middle holding the bag. Like, you know, Abu Ghraib, of course, it was supposedly, you know, half a dozen bad apples. What's to prevent that from happening here, where some low person or middle person gets stuck holding the bag?
Well, I mean, I'm confident that the people that we know of in Florida who have already gone on record as whistleblowers, unfortunately one person who was onto this died last year under some very mysterious circumstances. My hope is that, you know, this will stick where it needs to stick, and obviously what happened in Florida with the development of the software was fully known to Jeb Bush, was fully known to the Speaker of the House at the time, Tom Feeney, who at the same time he was Speaker of the House of Representatives in Florida, was a registered lobbyist for this company, Yang Enterprises, in Oviedo, Florida, which has a lot of contracts with the Kennedy Space Center. Interestingly enough, Feeney's wife is an engineer at the Kennedy Space Center. The money that I talked about with Five Star Trust, it apparently, from all indications, may have been they may have used NASA contract vehicles to get the money to the software developers to create the software program, and of course Five Star was associated with Houston, and we know that the Johnson Space Center has contractors there, and the name Sean O'Keefe, the NASA administrator, has come up very prominent in this scandal as well.
Well, on that note, Wayne, we're going to have to leave it there, but thanks again for joining us, and certainly keep me updated with the story, and we'll see where it goes.
It's a breaking story as I speak.
It keeps on breaking, and we'll see where it goes from here. Thanks a lot again for joining us.
www.onlinejournal.com is where you can find Wayne's stories.
That was an interview with journalist Wayne Madsen by Mark Badawi and Pokey Anderson of the Sunday Monitor show that airs on KPFT Radio in Houston. Now, I'm going to read you the affidavit of Clint Curtis, the computer programmer who claims he was hired to rig the vote by Tom Feeney, now a Florida congressman. This affidavit can be viewed on the Internet through Professor Michelle Chisadovsky's website, globalresearch.ca. I have not interviewed Curtis or attempted to verify his extremely serious claims. You decide what weight to give his statement. The affidavit was notarized and executed in the state of Maryland on December 6, 2004. I'm reading from a facsimile posted as a PDF file. Curtis wrote, I, Clint Curtis, swear that the following is true and correct. I was born in Illinois, and I am 46 years old. I graduated from college at Illinois State University with a degree in political science history, and later started my own company and learned to write computer software programs. In the mid-1990s, I moved to Florida and later got a job with Yang Enterprises, YEI, in Oviedo, Florida, in August 1998 as a computer programmer. I became the lead programmer for YEI and had daily meetings with YEI CEO, Mrs. Lee Wowen Yang. At the time, I was a lifelong registered Republican. In the early fall of 2000, a man came into YEI and was introduced to me as Tom Feeney, future Speaker of the House of Representatives in Florida, as well as YEI's corporate counsel and lobbyist. I sat in meetings with Mr. Feeney on at least a dozen occasions over the next several months, and we discussed several potential projects to determine their viability. In short, I was the technology advisor to Mr. Feeney on these proposals. After these consultations, Mr. Feeney would advise YEI on how best to procure the contracts for these projects. During a meeting in late September or October of 2000 at YEI, there were four people present, including myself, Tom Feeney, Mike Cohen, Mrs. Yang, and to the best of my recollection, two other YEI employees came in and out of the room during the course of the meeting. Mr. Feeney said he wanted to know if YEI could develop a prototype of a voting program that could alter the vote tabulation in an election and be undetectable. He was very specific in the design and specifications required for this program. He detailed in his own words that A, the program needed to be touchscreen capable, B, the user should be able to trigger the program without any additional equipment, and C, the programming to accomplish this remain hidden even if the source code was inspected. I told him that it would be virtually impossible to hide such code written to change the voting results if anyone were able to review the uncompiled source code. However, if the code were compiled before anyone was allowed to review it, then any vote fraud would remain invisible to detection. After further discussion, Mrs. Yang told Mr. Feeney that we would attempt to build a prototype for this program so he could see it, test it, and show it to others. It was my initial belief that Mr. Feeney was interested in such a program because of a concern that Democrats would try to use such a program to steal an election, and he wanted to be able to detect and prevent that if it occurred. Shortly thereafter, as directed, I created the vote fraud software prototype by making a software program where each candidate is represented as an element of an array of controls. Each candidate is listed in a database, and their number corresponds to where you want them to show up in that array. When the program starts, it reads the database and takes the number assigned to the candidate and fills in the label with the index that matches that number. That allows the program to work dynamically. It doesn't matter who the candidate is, as they have been equated to the index number assigned. From a normal perspective, it allows the voter to select the candidate, click on the submit button, and the candidate's selected previous vote total is then increased by one. In the vote fraud prototype that I created, things were not what they seemed. Hidden on the screen were invisible buttons. A person with knowledge of the locations of those invisible buttons could then use them to alter the votes of any candidate listed. By clicking the correct order of invisible buttons, the candidate selected by the user is compared to other candidates within that same race. If the candidate they selected is leading the race, nothing happens. If the other candidate is leading the race, the vote totals are altered so that the selected candidate is now leading the race with 51% of the vote. Other candidates then share the remaining 49% in exact proportion to the totals they had previously. In the prototype supplied to Feeney, the vote totals showed on the screen. In an actual application, the user would receive no visible clues to the fraud that had just occurred. Since the vote is applied by race, any single race or multiple races can be altered. The supervisors or any other voter would never notice this fraud since no visible sign would appear. Additionally, the procedure could be repeated as many times as was necessary to achieve the desired results. No amount of testing or simulations would expose the fraud, as its activation and process is completely invisible to everyone except the person programming the vote fraud routine. The same procedure could be automated to activate without any user intervention whenever the machine detects a certain pattern of voting. The algorithm could also be altered from hidden keys or triggers that would allow the fraudulent user to manipulate both the margins and percentages of any particular race. In most national elections, it is not necessary to win every area. Once I had the software program done, I wrote a report on how a person could see voting manipulation simply by looking at the source code. Any manipulation of the vote and the procedures for flipping the vote would be obvious to a competent programmer. I provided the program to Mr. Hai Lin Ni, the quality control person at YEI, and discussed it with him. He approved its distribution. I gave the software program, which was on a CD disk, and the report that was on disk and on paper, to Mrs. Yang. I stressed that she and Mr. Feeney could view the operation of the program and then see how to detect such fraudulent source code so it could be prevented. Conversely, if they allowed blind, already compiled code to be used with no source code provided, and there were no paper receipts, the votes could be flipped from one candidate to the other without any possible way for the deception to be detected. I explained that this could be done with a touch screen machine or automatically. She immediately stated, "You don't understand. In order to get the contract, we have to hide the manipulation in the source code. This program is needed to control the vote in South Florida." Close quote. I was shocked that they were actually trying to steal the election and told her that neither I nor anyone else could produce such a program. She stated that she would hand in what I had produced to Feeney and left the room with the software. In my role as technology advisor at YEI, I was present at subsequent meetings between Mr. Feeney and Mrs. Yang. In several of those meetings, prior to the 2000 election, it became clear to me that Mr. Feeney was well aware that by artificially reducing the margin of victory of the opposition party in areas where they were the strongest, the overall outcome would then favor his candidate. As well, he bragged that he had already implemented, quote, exclusion lists, close quote, to reduce the, quote, black vote. He further mentioned that, quote, proper placement of police patrols could further reduce the black vote by as much as 25%. I didn't know at the time if Mr. Feeney had meant that as a racial joke or actually part of the plan. Soon thereafter, I resigned from YEI and took another job at the Florida Department of Transportation, FDOT. While there, I discovered some other illegal activities of YEI who had contracts with FDOT involving overbilling and defrauding of the state of Florida regarding contracts that I had worked on at YEI. I reported this information to the FDOT Inspector General's office, and they began harassing me and another employee, Mavis Georgalis, who had made similar reports, and eventually we were both fired by FDOT on the same day. We later filed whistleblower complaints against FDOT. Mrs. Georgalis was successful, but mine was filed after the deadline and was dismissed. The IG at the FDOT, that's Inspector General, Raymond Lemmy, pursued some of the allegations I made against YEI, as I had advised him of the information concerning Tom Feeney and the vote fraud issue, illegal aliens employed by YEI, fallacious overbilling, and a wiretapping module that was placed into an FDOT software program for the document management system. Mr. Lemmy continued to meet and talk with me about matters relating to the case after I was fired from FDOT, and in June of 2003 he told me that he had tracked the corruption, quote, all the way to the top, and that the story would break in the next few weeks and I would be satisfied with the results. A few weeks later, on July 1st, Mr. Lemmy was found dead with his arm slashed in a hotel room in Valdosta, Georgia. Hylin Nee, the quality control manager at YEI, also worked with a company called Azure Systems of Orlando. While at YEI, Mrs. Yang provided Mr. Nee with many gigabytes of downloaded information from NASA projects that YEI was working on, including the Maximo Facilities Repair Maintenance Database, which he then took from the premises of YEI. This happened on several occasions. I also saw Mrs. Yang send a great deal of internal information to her brother in China, who, she had informed me, had been deported for spying. Wayne Leaders, an investigator for NASA, later confirmed this deportation of Mrs. Yang's brother. Mr. Leaders was responding to one of my multiple attempts to contact NASA on the YEI matter. I had also made a report to Mr. Leaders regarding a program that I had written for FDOT that allowed for outside contractors to submit documents to FDOT. Between the time I wrote the program and the phase of Mr. Nee's quality assurance, I discovered that Mr. Nee had inserted a wiretapping module into the software that copied all the information bound to FDOT and sent it via the internet to YEI. I have reason to believe that he also did this with a similar program I had written for NASA. In late 2003 or early 2004, I provided information to Detective Rob Pace at the Leon County Terrorist Task Force concerning Hylin Nee, who I had learned was an illegal Chinese alien. I informed Detective Pace that Mr. Nee was working at YEI on NASA programs. Hylin Nee was subsequently arrested by federal officials in Orlando, Florida, on or about March 17, 2004, on charges that included sending radar guidance system chips for Hellfire anti-tank missiles to a company in communist China. I reported much of this information to the FBI, CIA, Homeland Security, and Florida Department of Law Enforcement through emails, But the only one to respond was Tom Yowell, a special agent with the Florida Department of Law Enforcement assigned to the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force. Mr. Yowell responded via email on November 22, 2004, that YEI was under investigation by another office of the FBI, and that if I supplied him with my telephone number and name, he would pass that information to the other office so they could contact me. I did, but I have not yet heard back from the FBI or Mr. Yowell as of today's date. I have filed a QITAM, which is still pending, with the state of Florida concerning the overbilling by YEI. I have never been charged or convicted of any crimes, although I have been involved with two civil matters. The first is a copyright infringement case dating from 1997. The case was ultimately settled out of court with no finding of wrongdoing by anyone, and with both parties agreeing to pay their own attorney's fees. The second being a suit that YEI has brought against Mavis Georgalis and me in retaliation for reporting on its illegal activity. The YEI civil suit is still pending, and the court eventually required that FDOT be included as a co-defendant as well, because it was the sole owner of the software that Mrs. Georgalis and I were falsely accused of having appropriated. YEI employees have so far refused to subject themselves to depositions in that pending case. I declare under penalty of perjury pursuant to 28 U.S.C. section 1746 that the above is true and correct. And that is the affidavit of Clinton Curtis executed on December 6, 2004 in the state of Maryland.
We used to have elections that we don't bother anymore. Now it's just backroom dirty deals behind cloak and dagger doors. Oil money, family fortune, slapping each other on the back, putting people's lives in their pockets and watching while the money stacks. Goodbye, America, I'll say I knew you when. It was a long corner, turning, gonna be a long corner. Turning back again. We used to have our liberties back in the day, but it was for our own good that they took them away. Now it's Homeland Security following you around. Old George cut that cherry tree, and I guess it finally hit the ground. Because there's a new George now, and he's got an axe of his own, and he's grinding it real sharp, and he's cutting it to the bone. Filet of America, and he will feed it to the dogs, all for a bunch of good old boys riding high on the hog. Goodbye, America, I'll say I knew you when. It was a long corner, turning, gonna be a long corner. Turning back again. I'm getting used to surveillance and I'm getting used to the cops. I'm getting used to law and order when I don't know when to stop. I'm getting used to soldiers, I can see them in my sleep. I'm getting used to everything and that just gives me the creeps. They say that once we were a beacon and we shone like a star. 200 years later, well, here we are, looking out at the world through bulletproof glass, following a gunslinger preppy with his head up his ass. Goodbye, America, I'll say I knew you when. It was a long corner, turning, gonna be a long corner. Turning back again. We used to think we were so superior, we could tell God what to do. We thought we'd last forever, and we acted like it too. Living in a house of cards, waiting for a breeze. And I think I hear the wind blowing way up there in the trees. Well, I got my compass, and I got my flint rock spark. Nighttime is coming on, but I ain't afraid of the dark. I got my eye on the future, and it's all green and clover. So if we make it through this one, well, I'll meet you when it's over. Goodbye, America, I'll say I knew you when. It was a long corner, turning, gonna be a long corner. Turning back again. Goodbye, America, I'll say I knew you when. It was a long corner, turning, gonna be a long corner. Turning back again.
And that was Jim Page, Long Corner Turning, and this is Unwelcome Guests. Now turning to the dubious election in Ohio, where a recount is now taking place. This is breaking news from December 10th, from the recount effort spearheaded by the Green and Libertarian parties. On Friday, December 10th, two certified volunteers for the Ohio recount team assigned to Greene County were in process of recording voting information from minority precincts in Greene County and were stopped mid-count by a surprise order from Secretary of State Blackwell's office. The director of the Board of Elections stated that, quote, all voter records for the state of Ohio were locked down, and now they are not considered public records, close quote. The volunteers were working with voter printouts received directly from Carol Garman, director of the Greene County Board of Elections. Joan Quinn and Eve Roberson, retired attorney and election official respectively, were hand-copying voter discrepancies from precinct voting books on behalf of the presidential candidates Mr. Cobb, Green, and Mr. Bednarik, Libertarian, who had requested the recount. One of the goals of the recount was to determine how many minority voters were unable to vote or denied voting at the polls. Upon requesting copies of precinct records from predominantly minority precincts, Ms. Garman contacted Secretary of State Blackwell's office and spoke to Pat Wolf, election administrator. Ms. Wolf told Ms. Garman to assert that all voter records for the state of Ohio were, quote, locked down, and that they are not considered public records. Quinn and Roberson asked specifically for the legal authority authorizing Mr. Blackwell to lock down public records. Garman stated that it was the Secretary of State's decision. Ohio statute requires the directors of Board of Elections to comply with public requests for inspection and copying of public election records. As the volunteer team continued recording information from the precinct records in question, Garman entered the room and stated she was withdrawing permission to inspect or copy any voting records at the Board of Elections. Garman then physically removed the precinct book from Ms. Roberson's hands. They later requested the records again from Garman's office, which was again denied. Ohio Revised Code Title 35 Elections Section 3502.26 that requires all election records be made available for public inspection and copying makes it a crime for any employee of the Board of Elections to knowingly prevent or prohibit any person from inspecting the public records filed in the office of the Board of Elections. Finally, Ohio Revised Code Section 3599.42 clearly states, a violation of any provision of Title 35 of the Revised Code constitutes a prima facie case of election fraud within the purview of such title. Election fraud in Ohio. And that was posted by Ray Beckerman, a New York City attorney who has devoted his blog towards chronicling vote fraud in Ohio in the 2004 election.
Well, staying very much with the elections theme, joining us is James Galbraith. Professor James Galbraith has degrees from Cambridge, Harvard, and Yale. In the 80s, he served on the staff of the U.S. Congress, eventually as executive director of the Joint Economic Committee. In 85, he joined the Brookings Institution. He's currently a professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the Department of Government at the University of Texas at Austin. He's also a national chairman of Economists Allied for Arms Reduction. That's an international association of professional economists concerned with peace and security issues. He's published many books, including Balancing Acts, Technology, Finance, and the American Virtue, Created Unequal, The Crisis in American Pay, among others. Thanks for joining us. I wanted to start with your piece on Salon.com about the election in the Ukraine. You said that if the election in Ohio, which is the subject we were just talking about, was held to the same standards as the Ukraine, then the U.S. election was stolen. Can you expand on that and explain what you mean?
Well, what was striking about the American intervention in the Ukraine, Senator Lugar, Secretary of State Colin Powell, the International Republican Institute, the National Democracy Institute, was that they raised the argument that they made was that there was strong evidence that the process had been abusive. They didn't quite say, and they didn't have the basis for saying that the election was actually stolen. But the fellow that that they like, Yushchenko, got more votes than the other guy. But what they said that what they had was evidence that the election itself had been done in a way which was basically unfair, and in particular that voters had been intimidated and that officials who were the process had been interfered with. The officials who were committed to Yanukovych were in charge of the election machinery. And what I pointed out in my article is that of course describes Ohio pretty well. That if you're setting a standard that an election where the process is abusive should not be tolerated, then that clearly describes the Ohio election.
And if I can just give a quick thumbnail sketch, if people are not familiar with what's going on in the Ukraine, Viktor Yushchenko is the opposition candidate. He's seen as pro-Western, pro-European, and to some extent pro-US, and is thought to have won the election by a lot of observers. And Yanukovych, whose first name is also Viktor, is pro-Russian, to some extent pro-Soviet.
Obviously, there's a continuing crisis going on over there, and they have processes, including their Supreme Court, which has set aside the election results, which is moving toward, if not a resolution, further developments are underway. But the point is that let's assume that the case is correct, that the outcry was founded in not just a desire to see one guy win, but a desire to see an election process which is conducted in a fair and impartial way. What happened in the Ukraine was that tens, hundreds of thousands of people went out onto the streets in Kiev to defend that ideal. And under the pressure of that movement, the Supreme Court has now set aside the election results. That is a very interesting development, and one which has been obviously very welcomed by official Washington and by the American press. And again, my point is that in Ohio, the same thing could well have been called for, could well have been justified by the abusive process that clearly did occur in Ohio.
Now, by called for, do you mean by the media or do you mean by other people?
And anybody applying the same standard
and
to
why,
the Ukraine would have to be appalled by what happened in Ohio.
And what do you make of
I was in Ohio.
Okay.
I was in Columbus during the last few days before the election, on election day.
Mm-hmm.
I witnessed with my own eyes the enormously long lines that voters had to put up with in bad weather in order to exercise the elementary right of casting their votes. Those lines were there for a very deliberate reason. They were there because the Board of Elections had not provided an adequate number of voting machines. Franklin County, Ohio, and other places in Ohio had very complicated ballots. The election officials told me, about 5 minutes to vote, which means that a single voting machine could process 12 voters an hour, more or less, assuming there was a smooth flow, and that's a very limited number of voters in the course of a full day. A typical precinct, in the particular place where I was, three precincts were voting. Each of them had two machines. So they could typically process maybe 300 and some voters in the course of a 13-hour day. Now, there were in some precincts many more than that who were registered, many more than that who turned up and tried to vote. Those people ended up waiting in very, very long lines, which continued for hours after the polls were supposed to have closed. Of course, many people who saw those lines, who had been working all day before showing up to vote, simply couldn't stand another two, three hours in order to cast their vote, simply couldn't. Maybe they had jobs and they couldn't afford to take the 2 or 3 hours off that would have required to vote. And it was simply outrageous.
Yeah, I've heard
American
accounts.
American voters were put to that degree of trouble in order to cast the right, in order to enjoy the right to cast their votes. Secondly, the Columbus Dispatch did an investigation of the distribution of voting machines in Franklin County, and they found that in the areas which were predominantly inner city and particularly in the student areas, the number of voting machines was not increased and in some cases was decreased between 2000 and 2004. Increases in the total number of machines were allocated to the outlying regions and therefore tended to mean that the crush was a little bit less and maybe substantially less in Republican areas than it was in the Democratic areas. That's an abuse of process. That is using the election process in order to help one candidate win the vote at the expense of the other. That happened in Ohio. It happened systematically, as I saw in Franklin County. There are certainly credible allegations that similar abuses happened across the state. That's something that we ought to be focusing on. I should say this is really quite separate from the question of whether George Bush or John Kerry got more votes amongst those that were cast. There has been a lot of discussion about possible irregularities in the count. I don't know anything about those issues, and I'm not addressing them. The point of the matter is that we should not be tolerating the use of the election process to swing the outcome, to manipulate the outcome in favor of one candidate or another. And that is becoming routine in this country.
So given what's going on and what went on in Ohio, and I certainly heard accounts that confirm what you say you saw, and even people waiting as much as 8 hours to get to vote.
In some places that was the case, yes.
Yeah, and I actually know a couple of people who went through that. Given that, and I wanted to ask you a couple of questions. First of all, the way you're contrasting the election in the Ukraine and the way that's being covered and the calls that are being made by the Justice Department and Department of State and Colin Powell and so on and the media as well. Why do you think similar calls are not being made by the U.S. media regarding the U.S. elections?
Because the U.S. government isn't making them. And the U.S. media is in a comical situation, is parroting the statements made by people like Secretary Powell, people like Senator Lugar, about the Ukraine, refusing to ask themselves the obvious question, how is this different from what went on here 3 weeks earlier?
So our previous guest was saying that, you know, he saw red flags and alarm bells when the media was locked out of various places where the votes were being counted. Do you think he's being overly optimistic as to what the media would do in situations where they saw something going wrong?
Well, it's quite plain that the heavyweight forces in the American media wanted to get our election over with as quickly as possible. They were instantly talking about and putting pressure on John Kerry to concede, and they have moved on from the Ohio situation and have given it as little attention as they decently could, much less than they should, in the 3 weeks. So we don't have certainly have no crusaders for democracy per se operating that I can tell in the higher reaches of the American press, and to hear them talking about, you know, the sacred duty to uphold democracy in the Ukraine is just a little raises, shall we say, a tiny bit of skepticism in my jaundiced eye.
Given what happened and the way people were obstructed from getting to the polls in so many places, as we've heard, what do you think would be the solution for Ohio? Would you think a recount would mean anything, given the fact that people couldn't actually get to vote in many cases, or do we need to have a revote?
The recount has been called for, will be paid for, should be accelerated so that it could be done, and ideally should have been done before the casting of Ohio's electoral votes. But I don't frankly expect that you can overcome a deficiency of what is now 119,000 votes, unless the provisional ballots were overwhelmingly pro-Kerry, that you would be in a position where a recount of the ballots cast is going to make make the outcome change. You know, obviously we're not the Ukraine. We don't have the mass mobilization to call for a revote of the election. My point is that we should be mobilized and organizing to reform the election process so that we have elections which are much less subject to this form of abuse and manipulation, which is truly, in a fundamental sense, anti-American and anti-democratic.
And in the absence of these changes, do you have any advice for people in future elections so they can avoid these things?
What we should do is move to the Oregon system, a system which has been tried and tested and has proven to work very smoothly in the state of Oregon, which is vote by mail. There is no election day in Oregon. Everybody gets a ballot. Every registered voter gets a ballot in the mail. You fill it out. You sign on the envelope. You send it in. When the election board gets it, they do a check of the signature, and they then open the envelopes, separate the ballots from the envelopes, and run the ballots through an electronic counter. You have a paper trail. You save, of course, an enormous expense of actually running an election system with voting places open in every precinct. You save people an enormous amount of trouble. And you have an election which is far, far more difficult to manipulate in the ways that we've just been seeing. You don't have challengers at the polls intimidating voters. Simply you have people filling out their ballots and using the U.S. mail to get them into the election board. Oregon has a high participation rate, about 85% of registered voters, about 65%, I gather, of the voting age population. That's certainly it's not the highest in the country, but it's high by U.S. standards.
Thanks a lot for joining us. That was Professor James Galbraith. He's a professor at the University of Texas at Austin.
And that, again, was Mark Badawi of KPFT's Sunday Monitor, a program I strongly recommend you check out on the net at kpftx.org. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, KRFP Moscow, 91.3 Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR, Knoxville. For listeners in the Finger Lakes, an event sponsored by the Finger Lakes Sierra Club will look at the environmental impact of our renewable energy choices. It will take place Wednesday, December 15th at 7 p.m. at the Old Jail in Ithaca. The Old Jail is located at 125 East Court Street. When you hear the phrase environmental impact of renewable energy, what thoughts come to mind? Birds and wind turbines, embodied energy and solar module manufacturing, fish and large hydro plants. No technology or human activity, regardless of its apparent benefit, is without environmental consequence. Our collective challenge is to intelligently choose among those technologies which have the least impact while providing the greatest benefit to whom or what. Given a choice, is there a logical way to decide among the available renewable options of solar energy, wind power, solar water heating, or geothermal heating and cooling? Yes, but the answers may not be what you expect, says Art Weaver, currently president of Renovus Energy Incorporated. Art, who will be speaking on Wednesday, formerly worked as a staff scientist at Cornell University's High Energy Particle Accelerator and has MD and PhD degrees from the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota.